Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll talk with Marcus Murrow, a West Virginia native who's telling the story of Southern West Virginia and the surprising way cultural divides are sometimes bridged in and around Appalachia.
And I was like, I've never met anybody Jewish, man. I was like, that sounds kind of cool. And he was like, yeah, I ain't never met anybody from West Virginia either. We really were just kind of like, like this is a very odd time in life to meet someone of a culture and a background I have no idea about.
And we'll meet the next person in our Struggle to Stay series, veteran Mark Combs, who's decided to leave West Virginia.
It is a little scary. There is a definite feeling of fear that I'm leaving my home and the things that I've grown used to. But there's really nothing for me to do here.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On this show, we try to provide a platform for honest conversation about Appalachia and the people who live here. On today's episode, we'll hear from some people who have been inspired to do the same in their own ways. We'll hear from an unlikely team of documentary filmmakers, a photographer with a passion for capturing the essence of her subjects, and we'll hear what it's been like for the people on the other side of the camera lens, whose images were made into photographs. We'll also hear the audio diary of a woman struggling to overcome heroin addiction, telling her story in her own words. We'll start with a documentary that's in the works called Staring Up from the Mineshaft. It focuses on Southern West Virginia. Here's a clip from the film.
It's still one of the poorest states in the country.
Yeah, it is.
There is no industry there other than coal, and that's a dangerous job.
Yeah.
And when you look at all those little small communities, that's what they do. You know, they're poor, they got nothing to show for it, you know, and they come. It's not that they don't like black folk, they just don't know any. There's not enough of them around. That's why they didn't like Obama. Yeah. He couldn't get a vote in West Virginia.
Yeah. That's Raleigh County, West Virginia native Wayne Casey from the upcoming documentary Staring Up from the Mineshaft. Marcus Murrow is one of the filmmakers behind the documentary. He grew up in Raleigh County and lived with his grandfather for 11 years. Marcus enlisted in the Navy when he turned 17 and spent 4 years in the Marine Corps. He also spent 4 years working for President George W. Bush at the Camp David presidential retreat. After Marcus left the military, he earned bachelor's and master's degrees, and after a few different jobs, he eventually became interested in public policy. Marcus currently works as a consultant to the federal government. Apart from his day job, recently he began working on a kind of hobby project to tell the story of Southern West Virginia, a place that he feels is sometimes overlooked by the rest of the country.
So one of the biggest things that bothered me going to public policy school was that West Virginia wasn't a big part of the conversation. For me, I look at all these communities and they talk about helping urban areas and how they can help areas overseas and this. And I'm, you know, looking around at one of the top public policy schools in the nation. I'm like, why aren't you talking about us? Like, we have every need you could think of. And, you know, why aren't we a bigger part of that discussion? I think a big part of me wanting to do this documentary was so that policymakers across the country can understand that this needs to be focused on. West Virginia needs infrastructure help. We need opportunity here for everyone, so we don't have to leave.
You're working on a documentary that takes a look at Southern West Virginia specifically. Tell us more about the show.
Sure. So we really wanted to take a look at people who grew up in the coal camps. And coal camps were these really interesting areas where they weren't exactly cities. They were communities where coal mining companies had came in and set up housing and a pay system for miners. It's not legal anymore to do these type of things, but they would pay them in what's called scrip, which is kind of like an in-kind grant. You can't use the money anywhere else outside of these coal camps for goods and services. So the mine kind of owned everything, the property. But in owning it, they were also responsible for things like schools and doctors and health care and safety. So the mines were really in control of your entire life. So we wanted to go back and really kind of get a chance for these people that grew up in these coal camps to tell their story. And as we were hearing more of it, it just kind of came into saying, you know, this had a impact on them, their families, and a couple generations later. And personally, I started seeing the impact it had on my life from my grandfather growing up there.
So how did this idea come about?
My grandfather is getting kind of old. And he's hitting this age where I was like, you know, I'm never going to be able to have probably an opportunity for my kids to be of an age to talk with him and hear his story. And I said, you know, it'd be really nice if I could get an opportunity to record a little bit of his story. I knew he wasn't going to write anything down for me, you know, but he likes to talk a lot. So I said, you know, I'd like to film him. In the midst of us thinking of that, I immediately said, you know, this isn't just my grandfather. This is an entire generation of people that no one really pays attention to. And they just kind of get forgotten in the political landscape.
Marcus, tell me more about your life growing up in Southern West Virginia that you can, that perhaps we might find in this documentary that helps explain the complexities of West Virginia.
Sure. So I think one of the quotes that I use in the film is, you know, growing up, all I heard was either go in the mines or you go in the military. And once I got over 6'2", I knew I couldn't go in the mines. I was like, this is going to be hard for me to go down there. And there really wasn't any other option stressed on me. Not in a way that people didn't think I could do more. It's just they had never went to college either. These were the options that were given to them. And in our minds, like, mining was a great job. So growing up for me here, it is kind of isolated. I grew up in Beckley, West Virginia, which more accurately, I grew up in Stanford, which is an unincorporated town right beside of Beckley. And it was a great place to grow up as a kid. I loved it. West Virginia, we're neighbors. We're friends. We all know each other. We're kind to people. You don't weren't worried about locking your car or nothing like that. You could just, every part of it just felt like home. And so there really wasn't this idea of me leaving when I was a kid. As I got older, I realized, like, I don't really have a choice here. In my mind, I was like, I'm always going to get back to West Virginia. And I signed up for the military when I was about 16, and I left when I was 17. And after a few years in the military, it just kind of struck me. I was like, I can't really go back. Like, I just don't have an opportunity. I don't have anything to take back with me and do. So for me growing up there, it was a wonderful place. I think, like, other cities you see where people, like, go through their, you know, childhood, and it's, they have this, you know, I need the best new sneakers, I need this. And I was like, I need to hang out with my buddies, and, like, we work, and we, like, go mow the lawns and shuffle people's driveway for money, and then, like, we hang out and play basketball, and everything's great. And I think that I had a really good experience. Not to say that there weren't a lot of experiences that weren't good. I mean, there was definitely a racial element to it where there were a lot of people that were really racist. And that was hard, but it was still kind of I felt a little sheltered from it. I had so many friends that really just didn't care and would be just as angry if somebody says something mean to me.
So there's a mixture of some people that were really racist, but there's also a lot of people here. Would you say a lot of people?
I'd say a lot, yeah.
That were your friends and would take up for you.
Yeah, yeah. And that was probably one of the things that we also try and really explain in the documentary is that racism is a little different here in West Virginia. I said, you know, you hear these stories of the Old South and how divisive and how there was so much violence surrounding it. And I'm not saying that there wasn't that here. There was a racist element, but we have closer communities. You see these coal camps that we talk to, and they're like, yeah, we played with, you know, black and white kids. We didn't have a choice. There's just not a lot of kids, and there aren't a lot of toys. Hmm. We have to play together. So there was this real sense of a history of saying, you know, we work with side by side with these people. Our parents work together. So I think the racial divide is a little different here.
Hmm. Yeah, you mentioned before that you wanted to tell the stories of coal camp living and people who are from Southern West Virginia and things like that, talk to your grandfather and tell your family history. How important was it also to sort of dissect the diverse opinions or views about race? Or how important was that element in doing this documentary as well?
You know, for me, in the beginning, it wasn't as big an issue. I really did just want to tell a lot of story about the coal camps, but it just kept coming up.
How so?
In all of our interviews, people would discuss race. And some of that, I think, in white and black, people would discuss race. And in a lot of different ways. Like, a lot of people, you know, would say, yeah, you know, like, we had a lot of black people who were just saying, yeah, you know, there was people there that had it, but it just wasn't the same as in other areas. We've had other African-Americans. We interviewed Wayne Casey. He was one of the first people to integrate Mark Twain High School in McAlpin, a high school that Senator Byrd went to. And he talks at length about how much people, how much hatred was directed towards him for integrating that school.
Let's listen to part of this interview with Wayne Casey, who says the workforce in West Virginia was not so easy for him as a black man in the 1960s.
When I graduated, I went to apply for a job as a coach. They said, no, we're not hiring. You can't get a job here. Can't get a job in Charleston as a coach. 1968, college degree, student teaching, can't get a job coaching in West Virginia.
So I think that it wasn't really something that I, like we said, hey, we want to show race in the coal camps. Mm-hmm. It just kept coming into a lot of our interviews, and it got to the point where we were like, we have to put this in the film.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Marcus says he's frustrated by the way the rest of the country talks and doesn't talk about Appalachia.
We're really big on election year. You know, then we go 3 years and it's dead silent. That is what hurts.
And we'll also check in with Rebecca Kiger, a native West Virginian who's been documenting Appalachia through photographs for the past few years.
You have to imagine anything's possible. And then it allows for these magical things to happen in the frame.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
And right here is a spot for another underwriter. We tend to think our listeners are the best listeners. We have thousands of them across the country, and our show airs on 11 stations across Central Appalachia. If you think you'd like to connect with our listeners by becoming an underwriter, you can reach Jane Wright with an email to feedback@wvpublic.org, and thanks. Let's pick back up with my conversation with Marcus Murrow. He's working on a documentary called Staring Up from the Mineshaft. Marcus grew up in southern West Virginia in the 1980s and 90s. He faced his own struggles with racism, at least occasionally. Perhaps the worst incident was when he was playing basketball in high school.
I got booed. I got cursed out. I got heckled, flipped off.
By the other team?
By the people in the stands.
Okay.
And everyone on my team was just kind of like really taken aback. Like, all of us were just a little shocked. We didn't realize, we didn't have any expectations of any of that happening. And my one friend, Tim, he's a white guy, he played with me. And he still mentions that day as like being one of the days that he was just like, I can't, like, really shocked and taken aback. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was just like, oh, okay. It just, there was this kind of way of understanding that that's how certain people act in West Virginia. So for me, I didn't assign it to the state as a whole because I had so many other good experiences. Mm. Like, my friends were just as hurt as I was about that moment.
Marcus says he kind of brushed off the hatred and focused on the good of the situation, that he had friends who stood by him. But when Marcus shared the story with his college friend Mike Landes, Mike saw this story, along with other stories about race in southern West Virginia, as a bigger deal.
All this to say that when we hear from his grandfather about how things weren't so bad, and then we kind of delve into the conversation, and he mentioned how he was in the military, and he kind of makes an offhand comment about a race riot that happened, and we're like, are you like, well, okay, rewind the tape. Like what can we delve into that part? And it's just funny how, and I don't know if he's necessarily representative of the entire West Virginia black community, but it doesn't seem to be at the forefront in a traumatic way that you hear from a lot of other communities, but rather an understood reality that was something to be overcome as a community, and that community didn't exclusively include Black people. And I thought that was something that was really fascinating to hear from him, that this was something that we all dealt with together, and it was understood, but it was a reality that could be overcome with the rest of your community.
And it's the historical context that paints a clearer picture of racism in the region, says Native Marcus Murrow.
It's kind of a – it's an odd thing about how the coal camps were built. Like, a lot of the people that were coming were definitely white, but they're a lot with Italian backgrounds who were coming from New York. So they had already experienced a little bit of this being shunned because they were different. So I think while it was kind of still evident, it was still there – working together, you know, they're just so interconnected. Just because these coal companies at the time were just getting people in, just getting whoever we could in, you know, so that they were catching people that had been displaced from other communities, couldn't find jobs elsewhere. There was just this sense of everyone struggling together. And I think that didn't make racism disappear, but it just made it a little less like, look, there's only so much we can do. We have to live beside each other. We have to work together.
So talk a little bit about the dynamics between you two, if you can. So you said you're a Jewish kid from Massachusetts and you're a Black guy from Beckley, West Virginia. So how did this go? Well, or how did this influence the documentary, I'd say? I'll ask.
So I'll start by saying when Mike and I first met in grad school, it was pretty hilarious. You know, I think I invited him over and I was like, yeah, man, I'm going to make some pulled pork. And he's like, oh, you know, I don't eat pork. And I was like, oh, are you like Muslim or something? And he was like, no, I'm Jewish. And I was like, I was like, I've never met anybody Jewish, man. I was like, that sounds kind of cool. And he was like, yeah, I ain't never met anybody from West Virginia either. And we really just, you know, and Mike could speak to it a bit too, but we really were just kind of like, huh, like this is a very odd time in life to meet someone of a culture and a background I have no idea about.
I think that when it comes down to it, the thing that drew us together was that we both came from an environment when we were growing up and left it for something else. I grew up in Western Massachusetts in a very small town. There was some anti-Semitism there. I also grew up in a family who expected me to go to college and didn't see it as much as an accomplishment, as a necessary step in the process of one's life. That stood in contrast to a lot of the people that I grew up with. And we both left these places where we'd grown up and made a new life for ourselves and wound up in the same spot. And I mean, the odds of this happening realistically are actually astronomical, that you find someone who's so simpatico with you. But this is how we became such close friends.
And you became such close friends through the questions and the conversations and the curiosity of actually trying to get to know each other. Is that right?
Late nights and beer.
Yeah. Ton of like study sessions where we didn't get anything done,
nope,
but had a couple drinks and just sat around and talked to each other.
We've had about 47 conversations about what kosher means. That's been a...
Yeah. Yeah. For Mike, meeting an African-American from West Virginia piqued his curiosity because his knowledge of the region mostly came from national media reports.
A lot of states form a caricature of themselves when you hear about them, and none more so than I think West Virginia. Like, your image of a West Virginian is a guy with a coal hat on, carrying a pick. He's got some soot on his face, and his brother is Zoolander. No, I'm just kidding. But, like, you know, talking to Marcus, who it comes from this insular community within an insular community, I thought was really interesting. And I mean, everything else about it. I mean, feeling like he had to go into the military or the coal mines was a conversation that I had never had any thought about growing up. I mean, for me, it was always college and then career. And for Marcus, it was always either military or coal mines. And right there is the juncture that we've spoken so much about.
And for you,
any, so you, Mike, you mentioned perceptions about West Virginia because of the national media outlets, I'm assuming, and things like that. But as far as the Jewish community, did you have any idea of, or expectations of what you thought a Jewish person might be? Or
you know, the sad part is that I'd never actually met anyone Jewish. I had only seen things about Judaism on TV, but it was just kind of random. It was little stuff. It was like, so I really didn't have a history at all about what Jewish culture was, what it was like. I felt at a huge disadvantage. When we got to school, I felt like we had a lot of Jewish people there, and we had a lot of people that at least knew Jewish people or of them. And I was completely clueless. Like, I did not realize they did things on Fridays. Mike invited me over to Shabbat at his house, and I thought it was going to be like a church service, so I dressed up.
It's to my house, I'm wearing an undershirt and gym shorts, and I'm like, what are you doing?
So I didn't have the perceptions. And then I think as time went by, we just talked a lot about what his culture meant to him and his community and what it meant in mine. And I think that we really just came to a really clear understanding about how much it meant to us. You know, Mike would talk a lot about, you know, things that would happen in his life in Judaism and how he grew up with that. And I discuss a lot about, like, the community that I grew up in West Virginia, what life was like for me, how we helped each other out. You know, I think we were talking, we talked so many times about, you know, neighbors hunt. Like, even last night, we were talking with my grandfather about, you know, neighbors, you know, going hunting and getting a deer and just dropping off at our back porch. And Mike just didn't come from a, you know, like, community. Like, I was like, yeah, West Virginia's great. Like, you know, you're never going to go hungry. Like, neighbors are always going to help you out, or somebody's going to help you.
Nice.
Right. Mike found the more he hung out with Marcus, the more he learned just how much the media had missed and how much more complicated the history and culture of West Virginia is than the stereotype he first came to know.
I would say that I'm certainly not without bias, and that comes from growing up in the Northeast. I was in northern Appalachia, but it's still a two-hour drive from Boston, a two-hour drive from New York. And I think that that's a good way to describe it, that what I attempt to do is have this perspective. Like, you have a national conversation right now that's about the degree to which improvement is in our economy and policy choices that we make extend beyond cities and urban areas to Appalachia, to rural towns and cities that aren't seeing the same kind of prosperity that might come from the end of a recession. Hmm. And when it comes to a conversation about something particularly like coal, well, there are choices that are made locally that focus the economy on coal and place West Virginia in a tricky position in terms of rebounding when it fails. Hmm. But there are also choices made at the national scale that really target economies and specific industries that are the backbone of this state. And I mean, it's the I think that people are often more willing to move to one side or the other of that conversation. And one thing that we're trying to do is to keep that centralized perspective of, look, this is like any other community. There are influences within and without. And that's certainly what I'm trying to bring to the table.
While they both are working toward providing a deeper understanding of Appalachia, for Marcus, the film is also a way to document his family and preserve their place in history.
And I'd say, like, for me, looking at a lot of the politics around growing up here and looking at it on a national level, I feel like we've just been forgotten. We're really big on election year. Like, we're, like, everybody wants to talk about, yeah, Cole, like, 3 years. You know, then we go 3 years, and it's dead silent. No one talks about us. No one thinks about ways to help us. Like, no one thinks about what we need moving forward. That is what hurts. Like, that's the part of me that I'm at a policy school where we're supposed to be making laws and changing policies to help the nation, and I can't help my home state. And that was kind of where I decided, I was like, I just want to be able to do something that makes people look at us.
That was Marcus Murrow and Mike Landes, co-producers of a film called Staring Up from the Mine Shaft, which is still being produced. They hope to finish the film and release it in the next year.
So we just heard from two filmmakers who are hoping to share a glimpse of life in southern West Virginia with the world. Next, we're going to listen to a woman from West Virginia tell her story in her own words, a story about battling drug addiction and the hope she found in staying sober as an example for her children. Wendy Kreitz is a single mom, a Christian, and a recovering addict in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia. She's on parole and receiving substance abuse treatment through the Jeffrey Day Report Center. Kreitz has been using drugs since she was 13, intravenously since she was 15.
I am Wendy Kreitz. We're in the Daily Report vehicle in Charlestown. Yeah, people look down on people like us. Really, I mean, everybody has some kind of addiction. I believe it's that hole everybody has in their heart, that void that you're trying to fill. And I've looked for it, or I found it in drugs. And as long as you're getting high, you know, it fills it until the drugs are gone, and then it's back. So I just think that's something only God can do. And I think he uses our weaknesses to bring us to him. I have an awesome son. He's 12, and I swear I think God speaks to me through him sometimes. He is the sweetest child you ever meet. Just love him. Half of his life he saw me be strung out on drugs, so he's getting ready to be a teenager, and I just want to be a good role model for him. It's getting colder and colder out here. I don't even want to go outside when it's cold out, especially when the wind's blowing. But I do it. I walk or I ride the bike to work every morning. Okay, we are at Martin Luther King Boulevard. I rent a room here. I work at McDonald's on Tuesdays. I gotta be there at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I leave at 3:30. So I get up at 1 o'clock. I give myself 2 hours to spend with God.
A lot of the people that hurt you, honestly and truly, they really don't set out to.
I'll listen to some worship music. Not by power, but by the Spirit of God. I'm happy to be alive. Came so many times close to death. I hated myself. I felt ashamed. I walked around guilty, ashamed. I couldn't even look anybody in the eye because I felt so ashamed and dirty. So between the meetings, the counseling, the Suboxone, and God, I'm finally in a place where I'm sorry. The program saved me. I've been sitting around for how many days now since I broke my ankle? No bike, no work, and I've worked since I've been 16, and it's starting to get to me. Really is.
All representatives are assisting other callers. Your call is important to us.
I'm gonna have to call him. This is bull. I called like a week ago for this ride. They're saying they had me on their schedule, but I'm not on there. That's what they just told me. If I'm 10 minutes late, they do not see you.
Wendy, I was just calling them tell you what happened to me. I called the Day Report and told her that I had to get to the doctor's office, and Rhonda Eddy stopped what she was doing and came and got me there just on time. I'm so grateful for that. So I just wanted to let you know. You have a good day.
babe. You gotta go downstairs and get your book bag.
I have a fun test Thursday.
Okay. Do you know your words? Then we'll study. Very good. One more time, steadily.
S-T-E-A-D-I-L-Y.
Very good. Closeness.
C-L-O-S-E-N-E-S-S.
Yep, very good. I mean, my daughter, when she found out I broke my foot, her first concern, she said, was, oh my God, I'm afraid Mom's going to use again. She came up and spent the day with me last Saturday. She was off. She'll probably come over.
I'm Ashley, Wendy's daughter.
My whole life, I just feel like I've been let down. And we don't want to see you die, especially from heroin.
I can't change what I've done.
No, and I don't expect you to. All I want you to do is to never...
But I want you to know.
Please know that you love me.
And I am sorry, because I did choose drugs over you.
Clearly, she needs her Suboxone.
It's working for me. And I'm afraid that if I stop taking it, that I'm going to relapse again. So what do you do? I'm praying on that too. What do I do, Lord?
Thank God she just hit her 50th birthday. Thanking God she hit her 50th birthday.
Mommy, happy birthday to you.
Make a wish!
Yay!
This is my first birthday sober. Except for last year, because I was in jail. It feels good. I want to leave this world where they can be able to say, my mom was once maybe a drug addict, but she got her life straightened out. All your goodness I will keep on singing. 10,000 reasons for my heart to find.
You can find out more about Wendy and her story on our website and see this story also told in photographs on our website at wvpublic.org. That story was produced by Glennis Board and Rebecca Kiger. And in addition to producing the audio piece we just heard, Kiger's been working to document Appalachians for the past few years in images. Some of her photographs have appeared in the Looking at Appalachia collection, West Virginia Living Magazine, and the New York Times. And she's actually the subject of our next story. There are many different ways to photograph people, and Kiger has a unique style. Glennis Board has this story about what it's like to document a changing Appalachia through the lens of a photographer.
Rebecca Kiger is a documentary and portrait photographer born and raised in West Virginia. The images she captures are often exceptionally emotionally evocative. She says it takes a lot of patience and a little faith in both her process and her subjects.
You have to imagine anything's possible. And then it allows for these magical things to happen in the frame.
Kiger went south in West Virginia this year to capture images of ongoing initiatives in some of the communities hardest hit by the economic downturn in the coal industry. She focused on light and relationships to capture what she says is a hopeful scene.
Photography is painting with light, basically. And any image that really sings, the lighting is spot on. And then, you know, the question that I've learned in these last years to continually ask myself while I'm working is, why are you doing this?
Kiger says more than anything, more even than photography itself, she loves people. She says what motivates her to capture compelling imagery is the desire to help tell their story. To find out if she hit her mark, we asked some of her subjects.
That's pretty cool, actually. Captures the moment, doesn't it? Mm-hmm.
Danny Ferguson sits with Jacob Dyer. Ferguson is Dyer's mentor at the Coalfield Development Corporation in Huntington, West Virginia. The two are looking at some of the photos Kiger took of them while they were building a solar-powered training site in Kanawha County, West Virginia.
It was a rough day. that day. We was behind the gun real bad that day. We had a lot to get done by the time the concrete came in.
Ferguson is Coalfield Development's Lincoln County crew chief. He explains that in the wake of the ailing coal industry, his organization is working to create diverse, next-generation jobs.
I grew up in Lincoln County. That's the whole reason I took this job, is because I'd go to work, come home. I'd see all these kids with no possibilities. Couldn't get a job because everywhere they'd apply, they'd say, well, we want 2 to 5 years of experience. Well, how are you going to get the 2 to 5 years of experience if nobody will hire you?
Teaching young people from the region, like Jacob Dyer, how to work with and install solar panels is one way Coalfield Development is hoping to support a more diverse economy.
I'd prefer to stay here, stay home, and be around my family and everything, and, you know, help the economy, you know. I just want to make a change, and I'm hoping to do that.
Ferguson pointed to a black and white portrait of Jacob's face.
With the mud on it and the hard hat and like he's staring off, it just shows a lot about Jacob. That one picture says Jacob. I mean, that's what I would call a wall hanger.
Ferguson says while working, they barely noticed the photographer, Rebecca Kiger, but he does remember talking with her that day.
She was engaging with us on lunch and stuff. She was trying to find out more, and she took what she found out, and she actually said it in a picture. And to me, that's amazing.
I probably listened to and shared more than I ever have on any other assignment.
Kiger says she's grateful for work opportunities that allow her to put social media down and connect to people of all philosophies and backgrounds.
I felt hopeful after listening to them talk about ways that they can transform communities and build communities up. I loved every minute of it, and I hope the pictures that I take will bring more awareness and attention to their efforts so that they can grow.
The photos Kiger took were commissioned by the Claude Worthington Benedum Foundation, a charitable nonprofit that funds economic development projects in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. The title of their latest annual report, which Kiger was hired to help illustrate, Transitioning to West Virginia's New Economy. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling, West Virginia.
The feelings people have about Appalachia, they're complicated. That's why West Virginia Public Broadcasting, the Ohio Valley Resource, and the Allegheny Front have decided to explore those feelings, following 6 young people for about 6 months to see whether they stay in Appalachia or pick up their roots and look for a new life. The series is called The Struggle to Stay. Our first Struggle to Stay story was from 20-year-old Lincoln County, West Virginia native Colt Brogan. You can follow his story on our website. Today we move on to the story of our second person in the Struggle to Stay series, Mark Combs. Mark is a familiar face and voice to many of us here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. In 2009, Mark was featured in a documentary of ours about student veterans. During college, he worked with my colleagues in Morgantown on a project called The War in My Words, which aimed to collect stories of veterans who served during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We heard from Mark Combs last week in an encore presentation of Inside Appalachia that featured a special documentary called Still Taking Casualties. Mark hosted and produced that show about veteran suicide. Mark is among a community of West Virginians who have decided they have no choice but to leave the state. West Virginia Public Broadcasting reporter Glynis Board tracked Mark's journey as he made his decision to leave West Virginia and struggle to make a life for himself outside of Appalachia.
In the summer of 2016, Mark Combs was cast in a professional production of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet in Morgantown, West Virginia. He was fresh out of college with a degree in fine arts. This was his first professional gig as an actor. This would be his last performance in his home state of West Virginia. And when we met up on closing night, he probably should have been nervous, or maybe on top of the world, but Mark had just received terrible news.
You know, I lost one of my best friends last night to suicide, and he was in the United States Army. He was in the infantry like I was.
The loss of his friend, Tyler Burroughs, is especially tragic because, you see, Mark, who is no stranger to suicidal thoughts, just dedicated the last year of his life to raising awareness about the ongoing epidemic of vet suicide in the United States. He even hosted and co-produced the West Virginia Public Broadcasting television special called Still Taking Casualties.
I want to put a face on these statistics. I personally have known over a dozen veterans who have killed themselves. I'm tired of picking up the phone and hearing about another buddy.
I mean, it's the first friend I've lost in a while, probably about 10 months to it. And it's tough. It never gets any easier.
Mark Combs grew up bouncing around geographically between southern West Virginia, North, and South Carolina. He lost his parents early. To follow in his grandfather's footsteps, he joined the service. But 15 months in Iraq left him with several traumatic brain injuries. These came because of exposure to blasts from improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. In 2009, he was discharged because of his injuries and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Part of that disorder means he copes with recurring nightmares about being back in the war.
In the beginning, it was nothing but firefights and rocket attacks and mortar attacks and seeing IEDs blow up my friends and IEDs hitting me. But they progressed. In my mind, I was really thinking about certain things, you know, the aspects of really taking another human being's life. And it really started to bother me because that was one thing that I was known for. That was like everybody knew who I was in the battalion because I did that. And I did it more than anybody else. My dreams became just having to watch those people die over and over and over again. And that's pretty much what it is even to this day.
During his college career, Mark discovered a powerful new coping mechanism that changed the course of his life and was the driving force in his struggle to stay.
Honestly, theater saved my life. I hadn't been passionate about anything since being out of the Army, and I was still just kind of wandering around and just, you know, dragging my feet. But I finally found something that I love to do, and I mean, it was very therapeutic, and to get to do the things that you do on stage, and it's this beautiful art form. And it did. It pulled me out from underneath a rock. That's good.
After the final performance of Romeo and Juliet, while his castmates celebrated in the lobby, Mark and I sat down in the now empty theater.
It may have actually been the most difficult performance I've ever done. You know, there's a couple times I stepped into the wings and just kind of cried because I almost didn't want to be out there. But, you know, there's that saying, the show must go on. And, you know, I know if it had been somebody else and my buddy Tyler was here, he would have been there consoling me, but he also would have told me, you know, go do what you gotta do. And, I mean, it's basically all I could hear in my head all night. I got a funeral to go to this week, and then try to continue to work, save up a little bit more money before leaving for California at the end of August.
After a few years of weighing his options, Mark decided West Virginia didn't have a healthy enough economy that would allow him to survive and thrive pursuing a career in the arts.
I couldn't imagine doing anything else. I will never, I mean, if I have to like work a job, you know, at a bar or anything like that to help support, you know, get me from one job in the theater to the next acting job, yeah, I'll do that, but I can't imagine pursuing any other career ever.
Many of his theater friends moved either to New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles to chase their theatrical dreams. Mark wanted to escape cold winters, so he decided it was California or bust.
West Virginia is a really depressing place when you really get to think about it, especially, you know, if you're a young person who is looking to start a career.
Mark partially blames political leaders for not creating more economic opportunities for young people.
And the more you see in the news, it's like they're trying to make it worse. State government passes these bills that it's like they don't care about us. They care about coal and oil and gas, which are just robbing us blind and, you know, destroying the environment. And it just seems to me like they don't care about the younger generations or the generations to come. I mean, I'd love to be able to stay here. I do love this state, and, you know, the people were great, but it's just dying. And, you know, if you want to succeed, you got to leave.
A few nights before leaving, his apartment is stripped. He's all packed.
It is a little scary. There is a definite feeling of fear that I'm leaving my home and the things that I've grown used to. But there's really nothing for me to do here. So I kind of really have to leave here. It's like I don't know what will happen in California, but I know what will happen if I stay here. And one is definitely more terrifying than the other. Three days from now, I'll be halfway across the country.
So, Mark set out with a car full of California dreams and expectations that were, well, destined to be smashed to pieces. And quickly, does he make it to California? That's next time.
You can find out more about our Struggle to Stay series on our website at wvpublic.org. Who is telling Appalachia's story? I hope we never grow tired of telling Appalachian stories, our stories, especially as more people listen. We always love hearing your stories, too. If you have a Struggle to Stay story or just want to share your traditions, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us a tweet at InAppalachia or email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. And thank you for listening. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Ohio Valley Resource. Music in today's show was provided by Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Kai Engel, Dylan Moses McConnell, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our co-producer. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. And we want to introduce the newest member of the Inside Appalachia team, Claire Hamm, who is helping us with our digital content, among other things. You can also reach out to us with a letter and address them to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.